Common Sense Conversations is a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Independent, nonpartisan, facts, and common sense since 1995.
Hi, good afternoon, and welcome again to Common Sense Conversations. I'm Ryan Alexander. I'm president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. It's been a really busy month for us in D.C. at TCS, which is our acronym, because in D.C., you must have an acronym. We are, if you are new to this and somebody has referred you to us, we're an independent budget watchdog. We fight for the American taxpayer. We've been around for almost 25 years. Next year's our 25th anniversary. And we, you know, work in a nonpartisan way to root out wasteful policies that Congress is trying to pass. We read bills, we make spreadsheets, and we then tell everybody what we've learned. We like to look at things that aren't always in the news, but we're gonna start out today with something that is in the news. But before I do that, I wanna introduce everyone who's here. Steve Ellis, Executive Vice President.
Hi, folks.
Wendy Jordan, frequent guest on Common Sense Conversation, our national security policy analyst.
Hello, Ryan and everyone.
And Michael Maragos, who's a policy analyst on energy and natural resources.
Hi, how you doing?
So, as I promised, we're going to talk about something that's in the news today, which is funding to the Ukraine. First, a very little context about what we've looked into, and, you know, you might have heard about this over the last week. So as you likely know, President Trump made statements to the president of the Ukraine that suggest that the U.S. would not provide promised aid to the Ukraine unless the Ukrainians agreed to help investigate the Biden family. So lots of stuff you can read about that. What we're going to talk about is what kind of aid we were talking about, what our history of providing the Ukraine with support is, and kind of for what purpose. So what's being hurt or accomplished by what the president was suggesting. Wendy?
Yes, so when we first started hearing about this, which was only maybe 10 days ago, although it seems like a lot longer, that people really started talking about aid to Ukraine, I decided to go back and take a look. So TCS did some analysis of when direct assistance to Ukraine started in an unclassified format. I can't speak, obviously, to what might have happened in a classified realm, but a little bit of history. The Russians rolled over the Crimean border, or the Ukrainian border, eastern border, into Crimea in the summer of 2014. So summer of 2014, that means obviously the FY15 budget request from the Obama administration had already been made public in February. And a great deal of work, hearings, the beginnings of writing bills had already been accomplished, appropriations bills. So it was a bit of a scramble once the United States, and to a certain extent our NATO allies, had come together in and built a policy of how the United States would respond to this action. The first step, the first appropriation that we see to Ukraine is via something that was sort of hastily thrown together, the European Reassurance Initiative, which was funded from our favorite off-budget Overseas Contingency Operations account. And it was, let me check my chart, $175 million in the European Reassurance Initiative, which was at that time, it's expanded later on, and that's a topic for another Common Sense Conversation. It was at that time for Ukraine and the Baltic countries. So we can't say for certain how much of that $175 million went to Ukraine and how much went to Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. So that's FY15. Now comes around FY16, the budget request in February of FY16, and the administration had coalesced around a policy on how we were going to respond to the Russian incursion into Ukraine. So it ramped up very quickly. The funding request ramped up very quickly. The specific money for Ukraine in the defense appropriations request was $250 million, and more than $650 million for direct assistance to Ukraine in the State Department appropriations bill. That's in addition to funding for loan guarantees, which is a whole nother mess that I have I personally don't know a lot about, but many people at TCS know about loan guarantees, and we're going to be digging into that some more as we uncover exactly the amount of money and the risk factor that was established for any kind of loan guarantee to Ukraine.
I'm going to interrupt you just for a second because I want to circle back to the European Reassurance Initiative, just because we have talked about this before, but just as I was listening to you, I realized it might be helpful to circle back on kind of what it is and you know, what is, you know, obviously we are always concerned about things that look like long-term spending in OCO or any contingent account, but what, you know, you see in this fund is it's going to non-NATO countries that are allies. And you know, if you want to talk a little bit more about what we do know about it.
Sure. European Reassurance Initiative, which we immediately said in TCS documents isn't NATO the European Reassurance Initiative? But anyway, it was a non-NATO application of funds by the U.S. government to various what we politely refer to as Central European countries. We're evidently not supposed to say Eastern European anymore. So it became the European Deterrence Initiative, which is actually a worse name because they're not trying to deter Europe, but anyway. And it ramped up pretty quickly into the over $1 billion.
The European Deterrence Initiative was what the Trump administration rebranded the European Reassurance Initiative under the Obama administration.
We were now deterring Europe to the tune of more than $1 billion a year. And again, always in this off-budget account. So TCS has issues with off-budget accounting, particularly when you have a, you know, north of $600 billion defense bill, and you are also putting tens of billions of dollars into this OCO
right.
account. So FY16 was the high watermark. If you add in the value of the loan guarantees in FY16, it was over $1 billion in direct assistance to Ukraine. Then it lowered a little bit. FY17, $560 million. FY18, $620 million. And for everyone who's fascinated with these numbers, if you go to taxpayer.net, you can download the spreadsheet and read all about it. But one of the interesting things is that back in FY16, when we jumped up the amount of money to the highest level, the U.S. government specifically said that it was for, among the things it could be spent on was non-lethal, hang on a second, I have to get the right language, I want to make sure I get this exactly right, lethal weapons of a defensive nature only. So that was the boilerplate language that remained in the appropriations bills until FY19, the money that was being withheld until very recently by the Trump administration. And in FY19, for the first time, the language says lethal assistance. So we're still doing some digging at TCS on exactly what the change was, what they could buy or use that money on that was prohibited in the past. Also of interest is that in each case, within the section language of the appropriations bill, they specifically put the expiration date for the funds. It is in general, in an appropriations bill, you put the expiration date in the preamble to the bill. And so this time it was, in the case of Ukraine assistance, every year the expiration date for the money is in the section, which was a portion of why the Trump administration could put particular pressure.
Okay. Steve, any other deep and profound thoughts on Ukraine?
Well, this is going to get into, we're going to be talking later about the Anti-Deficiency Act, but clearly the administration impounding these funds, they could only do that for a certain period of time. And so it was really just about ramping up pressure, as we've seen from these transcripts and some of that information.
Okay. And typically, if you're going to withhold funds, if the administration's going to withhold funds, they make some sort of notification to Congress. And they either ask to reprogram that money into some else, or they officially rescind it, which appears not to have happened.
So it does. Well, thanks, Wendy and Steve. So If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Sense Conversations. I'm Ryan Alexander, President of Taxpayers for Common Sense. If you have any questions, please email them to president@taxpayer.net, and we will try to make sure that we address them. Again, thanks for listening. We're going to switch gears now and turn to one of our favorite topics, oil and gas leasing on federal lands. Last week, I was fortunate enough to testify before the House Natural Resources Committee about the many ways in which taxpayers are losing money because of problematic leasing practices on federal lands. I encourage you to go to the website, taxpayer.net, if you want to read the full testimony, or click on the link and watch the video. Here are the basic highlights of how we walk through the leasing system and how we lose money. First, there are low royalty rates. The onshore federal royalty rate is 12.5%, so that means that an oil and gas developer takes out, however much oil and gas, they pay us 12.5%. Many states have rates up to 25%. Offshore is at 18.75% in federal waters, so we're losing money there, in the 10-year period between 2007 and 2018, I think that's the window. The state of New Mexico alone lost $5 billion because of the low royalty rate. Another issue is kind of the rental fee that developers have to pay, which is, $1.50 an acre and some other details, but that, just very absurdly low rental rates that, make it easy to just sit on land. The other thing is kind of a non-competitive, there's a couple problems with non-competitive leasing. The way that land is supposed to be made available for oil and gas development on federal lands is that a parcel of land is nominated, there's a bunch of ways that can happen, and then it's supposed to be, sold at auction. So it's supposed to go to the highest bidder, there's a minimum bid, and the minimum bid is $2 an acre. So that turns out to be what many, many, many leases go for. So we're maybe with one bid, we're just letting go leases with very little competition. In some cases, people then come back after the auction's over and get them for even less. That also encourages speculation. So people just sit on land and wait till they think it's gonna be worth more money and then they'll give it up. And then finally, bonding practices, which is that, you can pay $10,000 bond that's supposed to, reassure us taxpayers that you will clean up all the mess after you have taken care of, you've extracted all you want to extract and any mess that's left over, that's all we get as a reassurance. So I'm going to turn to Michael Maragos to talk about some more recent leases, and he can add detail to anything I said because he is the detail guy on a lot of this stuff, but also, they're constantly leasing, so there's new information that we're learning all the time.
That's right. If you follow us at all on Twitter, you'll see that we are constantly tweeting about the most recent lease sale and how much we've lost as a result of some of these outdated terms. As Ryan mentioned, this whole system of oil and gas leasing, these rental rates, the royalty rates, the minimum bid, the last time that those were really updated was back in 1987, the Federal Onshore Oil and Gas Leasing Reform Act, or FOGLRA, as no one says. And
but it is an acronym, and we must have an acronym.
We're gonna try and make it work. And so it was exciting that some of these terms that have sat on the books since then were finally getting some attention in the recent hearing in which Ryan testified. And while these may seem like obscure things, how much are we charging per acre for lease agreements for federal land, they do add up over time, which is why, to the quote details guy over here, we like to suss out just how much that is. So I put together some numbers for today. There have been 7 oil and gas leases just in the last month and a half since the beginning of September. And in those, we've seen something like 415 million acres get sold, which is actually less than half of what was offered. Due to things like outdated royalty rates, or rather outdated rental rates and an outdated minimum bid process, I calculate just from these 7 sales alone, we've lost close to $300,000. And you magnify that over 30 sales a year multiple years, and this is millions of dollars. And then on the royalty rate side, once that oil and gas starts getting produced, then we add the B, then it's billions of dollars. And so this is things that really add up. I don't know how much.
Well, and I just think the other thing I would note about that is, so if less than half of the acres that were offered for lease were bid on and secured in that process, the other half might still get secured by developers. And Michael, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The big shift back in 1987, the Fugleraw, as we'll refer to it, that really shifted the whole nature of oil and gas leasing. Before then, 95% of all oil and gas leases on federal lands had been leased non-competitively. And the point was that Congress at that point recognized that competitive sales were the best way to get a return to taxpayers from these assets. And so the point was that every parcel now has to be offered competitively. But they left in this little loophole where if they don't receive a bid at auction, the very next day, oil and gas producers or any third party can get that same lease without submitting any bid through the non-competitive leasing system. All that's required is an application fee, which until a few years ago was just $75, and you could have your very own federal oil and gas lease. And so as a result, there's a lot of incentive, particularly in states where there's low competition, like Nevada, for no one to speak up at these auctions. And we've seen time after time, even the lease sale last week, where more parcels were sold non-competitively the day after the lease sale than competitively at the lease sale itself. So it's just building in a system where you're undermining the competitiveness. And as a result, we're getting less money as the owners. And one other point I would make, as we noted last year in an investigation, we worked with some New York Times reporters. This administration has been very vocal and aggressive in trying to lease as much federal land as possible, which means that there's always a pool of federal land that you can choose to offer, and ideally we'd want them to be strategic as what's going to get the most amount of attention from bidding from oil and gas companies. And instead, this administration's approach was like, well, open it all up and we'll see what they bid on. And to give you some numbers behind that, in the fiscal year that just ended at the end of September, fiscal year 2019, there were 2.6 million acres, not including Alaska. And that is the most in more than a decade that's been offered. But perhaps an even more telling stat, even in just the 9 months in calendar year 2019, there have been 2.6 million acres offered, which is more than the full calendar year in the last 10 years. So give you a sense, they're opening up all of these more lands that reduces competition per parcel, because when there's more available, you know, maybe someone, I guess, company doesn't want to bid on something they know is going to attract attention, they have to pay more for it, so they'll go for something else. But all of that means is that they are exacerbating the losses that we get from having these terms that were set back in 1987, from having rent that is $1.50 an acre as opposed to what it would be now had it been adjusted for inflation, which is $5 an acre.
So more losses, just good times for us and taxpayers. We are going to now move to one of our favorite, as Steve hinted, our favorite nerdy topics, the Anti-Deficiency Act. You know, bonus points for who wants to define the Anti-Deficiency Act, Wendy or Steve?
I can do it.
Because Wendy loves to, because she's a student of principles of appropriations law.
I am. And I would point out that in the world of acronyms, in the government contracts law profession, the Anti-Deficiency Act was referred to as the ADA for years and years and years. Well, then along came the Americans with Disabilities Act, and so now people who pay attention to this have to say it out, you know, string it all out, Anti-Deficiency Act. So for students like myself of this nerdy principle of appropriations law, it is 31 USC 1341 is the statute that is involved. And it prohibits, or actually what it does is it requires federal employees to report spending that is in either in excess or advance of a federal appropriation. So you cannot spend more than Congress has appropriated for a project, and you cannot spend it before Congress appropriates it. That's the basics of the Anti-Deficiency Act. The last time on Common Sense Conversation, we talked about one of the big whopper violations, which was diverting $3.6 billion, with a B, dollars in military construction projects from the states and military services for which it had been appropriated to build 174 miles of fencing on the border. But there are also smaller, less well-known or publicized violations of the Anti-Deficiency Act. And TCS wrote about one of them back during the shutdown of the government at the beginning of this calendar year, and actually also the January, I don't remember, January through about 6 weeks, wasn't it, Steve?
Yeah, it ran through the year, yeah.
Right. So during that shutdown, the Department of Interior was one of the departments that was shut down, and the National Park Service is part of the Department of Interior. And that meant that the national parks were closed, or should have been closed. But there was some unsubtle political pressure put on the Park Service to maintain, to a minimum standard, the parks for several reasons, but one of them being because it is it's economic stimulus for the regions right around the parks in the winter. And there was an issue with the fact that the bathrooms weren't being cleaned in these national parks and the trash wasn't being picked up. So basic functions of keeping the parks safe were being met by the National Park Service during the shutdown. In the beginning, volunteers, people who either worked for the National Park Service and decided to volunteer their time, or people from the local communities were going in and cleaning bathrooms and collecting trash. Well, that's also a violation of law. You can't do that. The U.S. government can't take volunteer services. And so it, well, they can, but in certain prescribed instances, of which this is not one. So the Park Service decided to divert entrance fees, gate fees, to cleaning bathrooms and taking the trash out. And although on its face that doesn't seem like it would be a violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act because entrance fees are not appropriated funds, in fact, because there was no appropriation for cleaning bathrooms and collecting trash, it is actually a violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act. It was obvious that there was some political pressure being put on by the congressional delegations of the states where these winter, these parks that get a lot of visitors in the winter were located, and National Park Service decided to go ahead and do this workaround.
Steve, yeah,
I was just going to add, Ryan and Wendy, is that, and this was ruled to be a violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act by the GAO, the Government Accountability Office,
or the IG,
one of the two. The Inspector Department of Interior, Inspector General, or GAO, I can't recall which. So it's not just us saying it's a violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act. The people who make those decisions actually were saying it's a violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act. The other thing I would just flag is that the normally what has happened in previous shutdowns are the parks shut down. But because the president had pretty publicly called for this shutdown and welcomed it and took ownership of it, they, as opposed to previous administrations, both Republican and Democrat, they wanted to minimize the impact of the shutdown or the perceived impact of the shutdown. So that's the reason why they were keeping the parks open so that people could still use them even though they were being people were camping where they weren't supposed to be camping, and there was the trash and the bathrooms and such.
And I guess the funds generated by park entrance fees are supposed to be put aside for cultural programs and deferred maintenance. Well, daily maintenance like cleaning out bathrooms and taking out trash is clearly not deferred maintenance, and so that was part of the decision-making process that this was indeed a violation.
I want to just turn to Stephen. There are a couple of other examples where the Anti-Deficiency Act has come up, not just the wall and the Park Service. There's been issues around kind of what we're doing, how they're reorganizing agencies. And then the other piece, which is, and I think we mentioned this in a previous Common Sense conversation, is that, you know, the administration used as a defense in when they were sued over the conditions at the border in some of the detention facilities, they said, we don't have any appropriated money for soap and toothbrushes. We don't have any appropriated money. So they said the Anti-Deficiency Act prohibited them from spending the money required to bring the conditions up to a higher standard. But Steve, you want to talk about some of the other?
Sure. There's been some instances at the Department of Agriculture as well, both in regard to moving of certain sub-agencies, moving their locations out, and then also during the shutdown, the prepayment of SNAP benefits, food stamps, which also, contradictory to a lot of popular belief, a lot of the recipients of SNAP benefits are actually rural people living in rural areas in red states. And so, again, trying to minimize the impact on people during the shutdown. And it's worth noting that, you know, during this 58, there were basically three shutdowns, a total of 58 days, there were 15 million, nearly 15 million work days lost.
Wow.
And I know. This is our, like, favorite fact to be like, oh, my God, I can't believe it.
And which works out to being about 57,000 work years that were lost. That will never be made up. It's not like... snow days, and that you open up, stay a couple more days into summer for school. You know, this is time work that we've paid for.
No spring break for you.
I mean, this is, and it was several billion dollars that just went out the window that we got no benefit for. And so, I mean, it really gets back to that nobody wins from a shutdown. They should not happen. Lawmakers, the executive branch, they got to work something out. Or getting kind of to the next point.
I was about to say, excellent segue from Anti-Deficiency Act to what's happening with the CR and what do we expect as we go forward?
Right. Well, before the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, they passed a continuing resolution to fund government at last year's levels with a few changes until November 21st, which is the week before Thanksgiving. And so, you know, it's really up in the air as to what's going to happen. The crystal ball is quite hazy considering the everything going on with the discussion about impeachment. And so it's unclear what will actually come to pass at the end of that CR, whether we'll see another CR, whether they'll actually get some legislation done. But it right now, nobody's even talking about are hardly talking about appropriations.
Right.
All attention is elsewhere. All the oxygen in the legislative room has been sucked up by debates over the impeachment.
Except for Ukraine appropriations.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Getting a lot of mess.
Right.
Before we go, you know, back to the what's going to happen next and how is this all affecting it, we did get one question I want to make sure we address, which is, you know, if it's illegal to ship money to build the wall, how can the administration do it and who can do anything about it? And what can Congress do? And I think there's a couple answers there. One, I think Congress could choose to sue the administration and the courts would have to respond to that. And the black letter law is pretty clear, so it would be fairly surprising if the courts ruled against Congress if they chose to bring that suit. Parts of the House of Representatives have sued the administration on other issues, but they haven't chosen to do it on this issue. In terms of how can the administration do it, I think that they're just trying everything they can do, and they're getting away with a fair amount. So that's kind of the short answer. But
on the Milcon thing, they have the hook that I believe the administration is hanging on was the emergency declaration,
right?
Which they believe sweeps aside everything, including the Anti-Deficiency Act, but it doesn't sweep aside the Constitution.
Right.
Right. The administration sent some of the military down to the border.
Right.
And then because they were at risk at the border, declared the emergency.
Got to build a fence.
To build a fence,
right,
to protect the military who were down there. So they created the environment that then became the justification for the emergency declaration.
Right.
The self-licking ice cream cone, as we call it.
Yeah. So back to the kind of what's coming up next, and more specifically, we started with Ukraine, something that's in the news, and we're going to end with just talking about kind of impeachment. How does this affect anything? Everything. Well, not anything, because we're going to just talk about appropriations and what's going to happen with spending and what the various options are, because it makes it really difficult to get things done that almost always have been moved forward with bipartisan cooperation. So predictions, observations?
My guess is that defense and probably the Coast Guard, separate from the rest of the Department of Homeland Security, will be funded. I don't think any of the politicians in Washington at either end of Pennsylvania Avenue want to have a repeat of, oh, the Coast Guard people aren't getting paid, but these other people are being paid. So my guess is that will happen. They will be funded, and that portion of national security will go forward. I think Steve and I talked about this earlier today. I think Steve is right that Homeland Security is really the crux. The rest of the Homeland Security bill is really the crux of the shutdown showdown.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that they actually did a legislative fix where the Coast Guard would get paid and the Coast Guard authorization. I just don't know if that's been enacted yet, but mm-hmm. it has been moving through Congress, and mm-hmm. I think that's pretty likely that will happen. But I think also I would err more on the side of thinking that there's going to be another continuing resolution. I don't think any Republicans or Democrats in the Congress want to see a shutdown, or hardly any. I don't know about the administration, so I see a shutdown as not being that likely. And so, particularly leading right into Thanksgiving, but it probably would be another short-term CR that gets you through the new into 2020, but doesn't mm-hmm. actually resolve the issues. But we'll see.
Right, and the politics of a shutdown in an election year, everybody's got ideas about what that are, what those would be. I think that everybody's fear of those politics will be what keeps us out of a shutdown. Mm-hmm. But the big questions on the Homeland Security bill and on the wall and
fence.
Well, but they still want it to be a wall. Are going to be some of the things that it's just we don't know what that outcome is going to be. We are reaching. I believe we're even 2 minutes over our half an hour, which we try to keep this at, but that's because we're so full of interesting facts. Thank you again for joining us. It's Common Sense Conversations. I'm Ryan Alexander, and we hope you will join us next time, which will be on November 4th.
You've been listening to Common Sense Conversations, a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. To find out more about us, go to www.taxpayer.net.